طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where you hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, which is so often missing in the news and analysis as presented in the Western media. This week, the entire program is given over to the featured Palestinian voice of activist Nidal Al-Azraq. Nidal, born and raised in the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem, now lives in the Boston area, where he is executive director of the nonprofit organization One for Three, which focuses on working to bring clean water to the West Bank of Palestine in the face of incredible shortages due to the discriminatory water policies of Israel, which completely controls all flow of water in both Israel and Palestine. We sat down with Nidal in this extended conversation to discuss his people and his work. Nidal, thank you for your willingness to speak to us on This Week in Palestine. We want to talk with you this morning about the place where you grew up, where much of your family lives to this day, and the place to which you return with great regularity. And that is the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem in the West Bank of Palestine. You, your wife and daughter now live in the greater Boston area, but we know your heart is always with your people in the Aida camp. Is that safe to say?
That is very safe to say, yes.
Aida seems to be of constant concern to the Israeli military these days. It's a place where the resistance to occupation is alive and well, and therefore has become a flashpoint for military intrusions on a regular basis. Tell us about Aida. What is going on there to merit such a pushback by the Israeli military?
Well, first, the last report for the United Nations that came out considered Aida to be the second most tense refugee camps in the West Bank after Shafat camp in Jerusalem. And this is due to its location, geographic location in Bethlehem City. You know, Aida camp is next to an Israeli military base, which is surrounded by Rachel's tomb, and is very close to one of the major settlements in the West Bank, which is Gilo settlement. And this is why Israel decided to surround this wall, this camp with 8-meter concrete wall from two sides and a military base from the third side. But this goes back, historically, even in the First Intifada, but we don't want to go all the way to the First Intifada. Let's start from 2004. And this is when new generation, the young youth and even children in the camp starting to jump in into the resistance. Unfortunately, if we remember the second intifada that started in 2000, and if we look carefully about what happened and the ideology or the plan that Israel implemented on the Palestinians, Israel succeeded in cleaning the Palestinian streets from the good active leaderships through assassinations, through arrests and sentencing them to life sentence and sending them to the exile. So practically what Israel did is to leave the Palestinian streets to the Palestinian Authority, which unfortunately they have done nothing to help the Palestinians during that time, especially the youth and the young generations. So this young generation that I'm talking about, which I have been following for the past, 12 years, intensively following them, not only in Aida camp, but in other refugee camps across the West Bank, was born, during the Oslo period, did not witness the first intifada, only heard about the glory and amazing stories about the first uprising in mid-80s and early 90s, but lived and witnessed the brutality of the second intifada that started in 2000.
You were how old at this point?
In which one?
In the first intifada, you were...
Well, the first intifada, let's say, born in 78 and 60, 70, 87, 86. We're talking about, you know, 10, 11, 13 years old, growing up to 14 years old.
That's the first one.
Yeah. And, yeah, in early mid-20s, in the second intifada, that started.
Was that much more visible in Ida Camp than the first intifada? Because you said you weren't that aware of the first intifada?
No, I was very aware.
Much?
I was aware of the first intifada, but the generation that really was born during the Oslo period did not really witness anything of the first intifada.
Yeah.
Only heard about the amazing stories that happened back then.
Right.
But no, I remember everything. I even participated in young age in the first intifada, as many, many kids and youth, especially in early 90s, before Oslo came. So this young generation grow up to 2004, they were like 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, and not much going on for them in other refugee camp. And during that time, Israel started building the wall around Ida camp. And here, this generation really took the lead in resisting the occupation inside the camp and around the camp, and trying to manage to stop the wall around the camp. And they did. I remember in 2004, they really managed to stop the construction on the wall for completely like 2 weeks, which drove the Israelis nuts.
How did they do that? With just active resistance?
It's active the resistance, ongoing, non-stop demonstrations that include, of course, throwing stones and Molotov cocktails and confrontations with the Israeli army every single day, 7 days a week, non-stop, for months and months and months. During that time, they did not stop, which led to the Israelis back then, they were really going crazy about that. And this is why the Mukhabarat, you know, made the decision is to arrest most of the teenagers in our refugee camp. And they sure did. I remember sometimes around 2004 and 2005 walking in either streets and not seeing many young folks in the streets because they were locked inside the prison. And as you know, Israel prison is not a normal prison. Prison everywhere is not normal, but the Israelis, how they did put their focus on this young generation, not only to arrest them that the war will continue around Ida camp. Now they arrested them and they had them pass through really severe physical and psychological torture and interrogations at the prison. And they really give them high sentences starting from 6 months to 3 years for participating in this type of demonstrations and resistance. And the sad part of this story that Israel did not leave this generation alone. So this generation started growing up in Ida camp, going to prison for 3 months, 6 months, 3 years. Coming back from prison, they will arrest the same exact people again and again and again for the fourth or the fifth times. And some of them have been in prison, are still in prison until these days. So when you think about it, you know, this generation really has spent almost half of their life inside the prison, facing really severe prison conditions inside, and coming back to where they were born and raised, to either refugee camp, to a much worse situation. Now, Israel's plan is to really destroy the spirit, destroy this generation. What they did not realize, really, is that they're sending these young men to the same location, which is as miserable as it could be. There's no, you know, very crowded, lack of opportunities, not much jobs going on. The army presence is very heavy, surrounded by the wall from two sides.
And really cut off from their families, because I understand visitation rights, all those kinds of things.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But the problem is, now you're talking about this generation is about like mid-20s, and they don't have really a lot of, many of them don't have higher education or, you know, baccalaureate degree. They don't have saving. And in our culture as Arab, you know, the man needs to have a lot of saving and a finished house to be able to marry and establish a family. So this generation lived with their families, and that's a problem, you know. And this led to other families of, you know, led to, you know, other young men and men from outside the camp to marry women from inside the camp, because and leaving the camp with higher male presence than female presence, you know.
Yes.
So putting all these elements together, what left for this generation?
Yeah.
And it led, this led to, and this, the very interesting thing that I want to say here, this group of generation, group of young men, when they came out of prison the first time and the second time and the third time and the fourth time, did not stop resisting. Did not. They were badly hurt inside the prison. They had, they were very frustrated. Very frustrated from inside. Not much going on inside the camp for them. Amazingly enough, they still have this charisma, this motivation and resistance to occupation. Okay? And if you look at what's happening right now, across the West Bank, either in the village, in the refugee camp, in the city, who's leading these demonstrations, who's leading these attacks, is the same generation that have been subjected to all these imprisonments throughout these years. So this is a result of a lot of oppression, a lot of imprisonments, a lot of lack of opportunities for this generation. And I don't know if it's good or bad, but I think it's good. The people who are leading or participating heavily in the current events across the West Bank and in Jerusalem, they really send a clear message to both the Palestinian Authority and to the political movements that what's happening is not led by you. What's happening has nothing to do with you. So they're really thirsty for another leadership, thirsty for a new face, a new agenda, a new vision or goals. Unfortunately, no one until now from the Palestinian society is stepping in, either political movements or the PA or anyone stepping in and having clear agenda for what's happening or leading this spark to somewhere. And this is why you hear every day, like 1 to 4 people will be shot and killed, a lot of demonstrations. But where are we going, to where this is heading toward, we really don't know.
Don't know. And the impact on Palestinian culture, that a whole generation of men cannot participate in the culture as it, you know, as they understand it, in terms of, as you said, in terms of being able to buy homes or accumulate enough wealth to marry, to have a job, to have any normal life as they understand, you know, as they understand in the culture, the impact must be incredible in terms of family life. What's happening to this generation in terms of their vision of the future?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. And not only that, if you look at the population of the West Bank, and let's take the refugee camps, okay? Right now, you cannot extend the refugee camp. You know, the refugee camps are surrounded by small streets and cities and even walls in some locations. And Palestinians who live in the refugee camps, they cannot build any more floors on top of each other, because the first floor cannot handle any more floors.
Yeah.
Because when they built the camp in the past, you know, when they built the first floor and the foundation, they did not, it wasn't designed to carry 6 and 10 floors. So imagine now there's like 2 other generations coming in from the refugee camps, age 10 to age 14, going through the same exact experience. But thinking about the mid-20 right now generation who's still stuck with their parents, still stuck with the resistance and subjected to arrestment, with no future, no house, no independent life, so to speak, you know. At the same time, you cannot really build a space for them in the camp. At the same time, their families cannot really buy a property or a land outside of the camp because it's extremely expensive. One, second, there's not much land left. So imagine this situation continues for the next, I don't want to say 10 years or more, for the next 4 or 5 years. It's going to be really a big explosion. Toward what? Against who? Against a bigger explosion against the occupation or against the Palestinian Authority, against the UNRWA, against who? I really don't know.
Because there's this sort of spirit of, what do we have to lose? I mean, you see what's going on with young Palestinians attacking Israelis. These are suicide missions. I mean, and what does it take to do that? It takes, what else is there for me to do? I need to resist. I have no future, and it just leads to this despair and to this pushback.
That's another excellent point. Palestinians for the past couple of years has been yelling and screaming for everyone, for the United Nations, for the PLO, for the international community, for the PA. Things are really getting so hard for us. Palestinian state is very close to lose the hope. And if Palestinians lost the hope, that's a really big problem. They did not lose it yet. Yes, young men and even young women and young generation is really, very, very frustrated. There's not much going on for them. But without finding a mechanism right now, a mechanism to empower the community, to empower this generation, I think it's going to lead to even more explosions and more and more bigger thinking among these people.
Because it certainly will, and Israel doesn't see this. I mean, the Israel right is building this bomb, really. I mean, the response always is a military response. It's always the same response, and there's no creative answer to trying to deal with this explosion. It's occurring, and it's going to get much worse.
Yeah, if you noticed since last October, if you noticed about the actions that the Palestinian state have been, against either settlers or Israeli soldiers or at the checkpoints or in Jerusalem. Basically, either like stabbing or like with cars or like. So Palestinians, until this moment, they did not really start doing big actions, And until now, they're really, they will think about the consequences. Of course, they will know that Israel reaction will be like, airstrikes and invasions, like 2002, type. But they're very close to do anything. And slowly, what I have been noticing, the conversation in the Palestinian street, that is, why do we always care about the Western view of us? I mean, we're exhausted. We're really tired of being careful, our way of resisting the occupation, of worrying about, they will call us terrorists, they will call us savages, they will call us violence, they will call us this and that, And they paid a lot of attention to that. But the international community, more and more the politicians, they really didn't pay attention to the Palestinian response in the resistance. If you noticed, let's say from 2005 or 6 until, until 2005 or 2004, there was not much really attacks from the Palestinian side. They're not like bombings inside Israel or blowing this or that, and nothing happened. Israel continued. The settlements continued. Everything, violating every single thing in the Palestinian lives. Palestinians live on only 11% of the land. This 11% is not really one unit. They killed the two-state solutions. It's really not worth talking about the two-state solutions geographically and demographically. It won't work. It would be naive to think that Israel will just withdraw settlements and move this wall. And it's not going to happen. So, with all of this trying, with Israel, with all of this, you have right-wing government, but also you have the failure of the Palestinian Authority with its political leadership. So what's left of the Palestinians?
Yeah.
You know?
The Zionist vision always has been to take the land, and since Oslo, the so-called peace process, all that's done is give Israel the time to do what it knows it has to do, and that's take the land, take the land. They just, you know, and the international community sits and wrings its hands, and why don't we have a peace process? Well, Israel's getting what it wants.
That's
true. It's taking the land. It's taking the land. But it is not calculating, as we've talked about, the explosion that's within. When you have all of these people here, and what are you going to do? What are you going to do about that? And they're just not factoring that in. They think that the repression and military might, et cetera, will contain it. And anyone looking at history knows that doesn't work.
That doesn't work. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, okay. Tell us about Lodgy. The community center in the middle of this incredible Ida refugee camp, and the work it tries to do with this generation of kids and this population.
Well, the idea of Lodgy came from a group of men and women in 2001. This group of men and women who have a long history in the political activities and activism and even the resistance of the Palestinian Intifada, they came together around the time 2000-2001 saying that we really need to have a safe place, a ground for the kids and youth to meet and talk, because Ida Camp was a war zone meaning Apaches and airstrikes and tanks and invasions and killing and bombing the houses was really, really a real war zone. And I remember in the past, the idea came was okay, we need a space to bring the kids, to bring the children, to just protect them from getting lost with this mess. Okay, and it was a simple idea. We did not have location, physical location. We did not have space. We used to work in people's houses, in the schools, in the streets, up until around the time of 2003. We rented a small place in Ida refugee camp, two garages, actually.
So you were in the beginning of this?
Yeah. We rented these two small places in the middle of the camp, and we start running art activities, other activities with the kids and youth to come and feel like somebody's paying attention to us. And then the idea become really much bigger, and the interest from both the kids and youth and their families in having a good, not politicized place for the kids, growing. So we decided to really move out, not outside of the camp, just move out of this small location and build a new location. Now this location where Lodgy is now, yes, they cover the art section, the media, they cover the environment section in terms of rooftop gardens and water and other activities. Now, Lodgy Center is an umbrella for 12 different refugee camps, which responsible for running projects in 12 different refugee camps across the West Bank, with college students and youth activities, actually. But why? Why are we doing that? Why Lodgy is doing that, actually? One main thing among this really hard and tough situation is to empower the people, to empower this generation, to educate this generation to reach to the point where they can really decide and choose by themselves what do they want to do, what they want to become. As we know, it's heavily politicized, the West Bank. These youth and young generations could get involved in so many things, either political activities and non-political activities. Focus on giving them the opportunity to learn about not only their history, but about their identity and memory. a lot of work that we do at LEGI and the folks they do at LEGI is to focus on the history of the conflict and the Palestinian society. For example, I ran a workshop with the 73 college students from 12 different refugee camps for 4 months on the theme of identity and memory. It's like before you want to get involved in anything, you need to know who you are. What is your identity? Mm-hmm. You're a Palestinian, you're an Arab, you live in the Middle East. Right. But you have a forced identity that was forced on you being refugees. This was not your choice. What do you do with it? The history, not only what happened, but how did it happen? Who's responsible? So you need to know all these facts as a young. Before you jump, growing up, knowing these facts, it will help this generation. Not figuring out even what to do, like a clear idea of where to go, because it's very easy for any Palestinian, based on the current situations, to get involved with resistance, get involved with political activities, etc.
The traditional family and the traditional culture has been so interrupted that the kinds of things that were handed down through family and through the marriages and the whole thing is totally interrupted.
That's a good point. I was going to talk about it after this. I mean, look, take Ada refugee camp. Ada refugee camp has around actually more than 5,000 people because we shouldn't trust any statistics of the UNRWA that's on their website.
Yeah, right.
Never been updated. They didn't do the research. They don't update their numbers or anything. Half of this population is under the age of 18. It's a pretty crowded place.
Oh,
practically, you can cross half the camp without walking in the streets, from a rooftop to a rooftop to a rooftop.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And families are very important, socially and politically, actually. Not only socially, social aspects. Very, very important. But the family, the Palestinian family who lives in the refugee camp is pretty exhausted.
Okay.
Very exhausted. For example, the father, all what he thinks about is looking for a job, which is not my job, going out there to secure at least, not, I don't want to say, okay, secure food, secure other resources for the family. They have schools. They finish high school. Where do they go? You know?
The schools where? Are they mostly the UNRWA schools?
Well, there's like a very bad UNRWA school system in Alicante, especially the boys' school. Extremely horrible, you know? But they manage to finish mid school and they go to high school and they finish high school. College is very expensive there. To the Palestinian standards, it's very expensive. What do you do? And for Palestinians that I have been noticing, college is very important. And if you look at the generations of Palestinians, they always finish their bachelor degree and master degree when they're like 35 or 40 years old. Why? Because there are really many, many folks who finish high school, their families don't have the money. They don't have the money to send them to college because if you have 3 children or 5 children, the first child will go to college. Next year or next 2 years, the second child will go to college. Sometimes you end up with 3 children in college. And who can provide expenses?
Yeah.
Cannot. So one or two of these folks needs to step out of college or don't go at all, go work, okay, until one or two finish college, and then you come back. And usually that happens, you know, much, much later. I finished my bachelor degree in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I finished high school in the...
How old were you at that point?
Up there, I was like 32, I don't know.
Mm.
But yeah, you know, my friends, my brothers, my sister finished her master's degree and when she had 4 children, okay, and her husband was in prison and she finished her master's degree. You know, there's this passion about finishing education. People love to finish their education, okay? They love to finish college. They love to continue. And
even
they love
though at the end of that,
there's no jobs, there's nothing, there's no opportunities, but there's something. It is as if like, this is my right. I need to get it. I don't care about putting the degree in the drawer or not doing or go work in the constructions or sanitation or something, but I need to get it. It's about like, this right is, somebody is trying to prevent me from this right or taking it from me. I need to get it. So it's practically okay, yeah. Knowledge is beautiful, and everybody should get it. But also, you know, I need to get this because there's somebody who's trying to take it from me.
Right.
You know, this sense.
It is a part of the Palestinian culture that really still remains strong, and that is this passion for education.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen statistics lately, but I remember looking at one point where the percentage of Palestinians with college degrees and advanced degrees put against even Israel
is very high.
It's very high. It's incredibly high.
It's very high. It's very high because Palestinians, an older generation, like my brother who came out of prison, he spent 29 years in prison. Okay, he came out of prison 2 years ago. After 2 years, he's at college now. He finished a year and a half, and he's 50 years old.
Mm.
Even though he doesn't need a college degree.
Right.
Sometimes the doctors in the college, they will ask him to lecture because he spent 29 years in prison reading.
Where is he studying?
At the university in Bethlehem.
Uh-huh.
He spent really 29 years reading and teaching in prison. So he's a very well-educated, brilliant man. But yet, he's going to college with young folks. He wants a degree. Why he doesn't want he why does he want it? I really don't know personally. But he just
It's a matter of pride.
This
is what I need to do.
Yeah,
terrific. Let's talk about water a minute, and particularly, let's start with how Israel uses water as a weapon. I mean, water is scarce. In Israel-Palestine to begin with, much of the water really comes from Palestinian aquifers. Israel takes the water and sells it back to the Palestinians at four times the price it sells to Israelis. They come into the camps, they shoot the water towers very often up above the houses.
The water tanks. And
which they need because the water comes in frequently. They turn on so people have to fill their tanks when they get them. Anyway, let's talk about water and...
But water is politics there.
Yeah.
Okay, and it is due a lot to the division of the West Bank area A, B, and C, and is due a lot about the path of the wall and the settlements buildings. For example, Area C, as we know, is around 60 to 63% of the West Bank.
Yeah.
Okay? And is fully controlled by Israel. Geographically, much of the aquifers, the good aquifers, are located in Area C. Okay? Geographically, when the rain falls and the flood water, water goes underground to Area C. It's like as a slope underground to go to these aquifers. So Israel takes around 70, this is based, if you Google, go to Google and type water in Israel-Palestine, it's amazing. You get, everybody agrees that Israel takes around 73 to 75% of the total water. The World Bank, the United Nations, Amnesty, even Israeli human rights organizations agree on, even NPR here in Boston, CNN, New York Times, everybody agree that Israel really takes over 70% of the total water in the West Bank, which is Palestinian water, and gives back the rest to the Palestinians, yet they take 10% of the 27% and give it to Israeli settlements. So when you think about it, it's less than 20% is left for Palestinians. And this is why, especially in the summer season, water is a major crisis in the West Bank, especially in refugee camps, in even in cities, you know, within Area A, you know. Because Palestinian areas in Area C, they're like more to get water because they're hooked with the same pipe as the settlements, you know. But in Area A especially, but you know, Area C is also facing a lot of problems with like the Palestinians will not be allowed to dig wells or harvest rainwater or build cisterns even. It would be really destroyed because as a Palestinians who live in Area C, You want to build a system to harvest the rainwater from your rooftop.
Right.
You need to get the permits from the civil administration in the army, in the Israeli army. You know, you go and you need to get a permit to build. And it's like, just like a dream to get a permit. And if you build it without a permit, obviously it will be destroyed.
Well, that's why I use the word Israel uses water as a weapon, because who can be against cisterns? Who can be against collecting water that's you know, unless you want to use it as a weapon, unless you want to...
No, especially in Area C.
Yeah.
Why do they do that, especially in the Jordan Valley? If you want to deprive or move one group of people outside of place, especially like people who really rely on some natural resource, you just take this natural resource from them or restrict it, and they would be forced to leave. And this is the goal in Area C, using water as we have been to displace and move people out of this Area C to Area B or Area A, because you have farmers, you have people who have animals, and you just, you know, you need water for your daily life, practically, in these areas. But the problem is not that different. There is a problem in Area A. I remember in 2011, I think. I was with my wife and my daughter. My daughter was like 6 months old. Mm-hmm. And Idakem did not have water for around 73 days. And it was hot summer. Which I had, with my wife, to climb from a rooftop to a rooftop to a rooftop with a hose, with a pipe and a hose, you know, to borrow water from the neighbors, to put in our tanks. No, to borrow water from my sister's house, which is like five houses away. So I start jumping from a rooftop to a rooftop to a rooftop with the hose and hook it with a small motor to pump water from her tanks to our water tanks that our 6 months daughter can take a very simple, modest shower.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the rest of the supplies is like everyone in the camp. You need to carry gallons and bottles and go to this small faucet sink, you know, and fill them with water from near Lagi Center and bring it to use it for the toilet, to use it for the dishes. Not much cleaning of the house, not much doing laundries, even, you know, showers is a major thing, and cooking and everything.
Yeah.
So imagine you live next to a settlement, ghetto settlements. You go to one of the rooftops with a good binocular, you can see a swimming pool, gardens, green lands, and you know that this is your water.
Yeah.
You look at the camp full of water tanks on the rooftops, full, empty, the pipes are rusted because the water is not running inside these pipes, and you really just, you know, wish to take a 5 minute shower or less. Yes, in some areas it's a weapon to move people out. In other areas, it's just oppression and keep humiliating people and treating them like non-human.
Yeah. In the hope that they'll somehow leave.
Yeah, well, I don't think they will leave, because if you want to ask people in a refugee camp to leave, they would leave to where?
Where,
It's like, yeah, in Area C and B, yes. Mm. But in the West Bank, you know, in Area A especially, where would they leave? I mean, yeah, it's just like, how can we make your life miserable? More and more and more every day. That's it.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
I mean, listen, from a Palestinian perspective, this is an occupation. What do I expect from an occupation? To treat me with flowers? Or it's occupation. It's an occupation. Meaning oppression, meaning bad treatments, meaning taking rights, this and that. You know, this is my expectation from the, my response to this, these actions, the people, the international communities, everyone should be really different, okay? Because especially here in the U.S., when you think about the U.S., the United States, and the American societies, it's very deeply invested in what's happening in IDACAM and other areas. Tons of tear gas will be thrown in people's houses and homes and rooftops every single day. And these tear gas is stamped with made in USA. The M16s and the rifles that the soldiers carry and walk in the streets of Aydekem and shoot at people, stamped with made in USA. The Apaches and the helicopters they use, it's made in USA. So the Palestinians' perceptions of the USA is everywhere. Okay. And this is your... We're in the tax season. Soon everybody's going to be paying a lot of taxes. Big chunk of this tax is going to go...
For this.
For this.
Yeah, it brings us back to the question we asked earlier, to what's in Israel's head? I mean, what... We can't answer this question, but... So you're making people's lives miserable. You're turning the screw, you know. You got your boot on their throat. What's the end game? What's the end game for Israel?
I don't know. I think when I think of Israel, I think about old colonized powers also. You know, would they use the same ideology is to victimize themselves and criminalize the victims? Okay? Not I think of myself as a victim, because if I think of the Palestinians people as victims, some type of a weakness here. But they always victimize themselves. And who buys it? The West.
Yeah.
Who buys it and believes it and adapts it? The West. Without really... looking, you know, 2 degrees to the right or 2 degrees to the left, and they will know the truth, but they always buy this story, you know, but the facts on the grounds are absolutely different. So in their hands, a lot of support from the major powers in the world, in their hands, you know, weak, full of chaos Arab regime around them, but more the support of the West, especially the United States.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about water, the issue of water, water as a weapon. Laji Camp and the work that you're doing with One for Three is trying to address this in some way. Talk about One for Three and talk about what's happening in Laji Camp in terms of trying to deal with the water issue.
Well, first, there's no solution for the water issue except dealing with occupation, figure out a solution for the occupation. So the solution needs to become from the political level. Okay, the international community needs to interfere, the UN needs to interfere, everybody needs to jump in to solve this problem. What do we do as 143.org with our partners at LAGI and other wonderful partners like the graduate students and professors from Tufts universities, graduate students and professors from Harvard also joining us in this effort, is to think about project that could be owned by the community to alleviate the crisis, empower the people, and keep them going with whatever they want to do. So basically what we did 3 years ago, we did not go with our plans from here and ideas and force them in the community. So we said, this is going everywhere in Palestine and we should really not do that, because people are smart, capable and skilled to do these things, but they need the resources, okay? So when we went, we met with the community, men, women, youth, even children. And we asked him, okay, what exactly going on here? How can we help? What can we do to support you? And the two major issues there, water and health. You know, Aydekem doesn't have a clinic, you know, water and health. And we said, okay, if we need to think about anything, it has to come from you. The idea needs to come from the community, and the community needs to be involved every step of the way. And they have to own it and sustain it. So we start thinking together, us here with them, thinking about, you know, ways of improving the water quality and a little bit the quantity in the camp, because the lack of water has been causing a lot of problems, especially among children in terms of diarrhea, fever, and all these things, because the tanks, when you leave the tank and the pipes empty from water for over 2 months, they get rusted, bacteria grow, etc., etc. So we asked Tufts Engineering School to join, and amazingly enough, they have been with us for the past 3 years, and actually we're going again in March to start a new location in El Walaja village next to Bethlehem, a new water testing program there. And we start doing water testing, taking samples of water from every single water tank faucet in the camp and families, and have big record for the past 3 years. So we have data for the past 3 years about the quality of water. And we found a lot of contamination that due to the lack of water. And the second thing we did, education pocket of how to clean the water. If you find contaminated water, some cases we had to change the water tanks. Very old, very rusted water tanks. Change them with the new water tanks.
But are the new water tanks plastic?
The old are minerals. And this new, actually a factory in Hebron, a Palestinian factory in Hebron, designed these new water tanks. White plastic layer from inside and black layer from inside and white from outside. It won't absorb a lot of sun, the white, not like the plants. Yeah. So we change them with plastic, it's healthier.
It won't rust.
Yeah. That's another major thing. So, but if you find contamination, we run through chlorine, through filters, we distribute to the people, and we train a very talented team in the refugee camp, a graduate student, Shadaraz, a young woman, right. And with a group of youth, how to conduct the water testing and follow the water situation in the camp. And we said, there is not a solution, but there is an idea, a brilliant idea, on how to increase the quantity of water. There's an empty spot of land next to the camp that left, and this is where the playground, the only 2,000 square meter empty land left for the more than 5,000 refugees to use. So we brought the grad students and professors from the Grad School of Design from Harvard to help us design with engineers and architects from Palestine, work together to come up with idea how can we increase the quantity of water. So they designed this a system where we can actually harvest the rainwater and clean the flood water. We found out that the West Bank has more rainfall than London City.
Really?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of rain in Palestine. So before the water and the flood goes into Area C, why can't we catch it and store it and treat it? And this is where they designed the concept or the project where we call the Aida Water Garden, which is huge cisterns underground because it's the only open spot for people to use. You cannot build any infrastructure in this land. The soccer field needs to be protected because soccer there is very important, especially for the young
folks. But was there an old cistern there to begin with, or is this...
No, nothing.
There was nothing, so this is a completely new cistern.
No, there's nothing there.
Okay.
So we designed first, we need to start with Larger Center. Large is a community, a very active community center that has a lot of programs, a lot of youth and children and families come and use this center. So we need to build a small cistern. So we build a small cistern, 50 cubic meter, like a good size cistern for Large to harvest to collect the rain water from their rooftop and store it. And sure enough, since then, Large never was out of water. Really.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this was like a pilot example of, it worked. So we need now a much, much, much bigger cistern underground to not only harvest the rainwater, but also clean the flood water. You know, this is why we asked Tufts to join us, because Tufts water expertise will take care of the treatment of the flood water, and the rainwater is rain. You can just store it and use it.
Now let me ask this question, just to clarify. Israel allows you to build this cistern because you're Area A. So it's Area C.
And B.
And B, both where you have to get permits to do this kind of thing.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And it's such a brilliant, it's not a rocket science.
Right.
It's just a simple idea. Why don't you catch the... Since you're not...
Thousands of years and thousands of years.
Catch the water.
People have catch water in cisterns.
Catch the water and catch the flood water, which is even more quantity. Catch the flood water, store it, treat it, and have people use it before it goes to Area C. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get the fund for this project yet. We run a lot of projects, rooftop gardens, water testing programs, water tank distributing, environment unit, very active environment unit that runs, works, you know, both the EU and the Palestinian Authority comes to this environment unit for help right now. It's sad that, you know, this small environment unit in Aida camp does better work than the United Nations and the Palestinian Authority when it comes to water, really. Yeah. It's very sad, but we created good programs in related to environment and water, but the big project, which building the big systems under the ground, we didn't do it due to the funds. And when you talk about, I mean, the whole project, the Isle of Water Garden, it cost around $600,000. When you calculate the $600,000 distributing to 6,000 refugees, it's not that much. You know, it's there, it's sustainable.
Yeah.
And when you think about the amount of funds and money that's been poured on the Palestinian society from the international communities and other donors, without planning, without sustainable plans, without ideas, it's like you build this project, you come next year, you don't find it because it's not owned by the people.
It goes through the Palestinian Authority?
No.
No?
No.
So
no.
You can get it straight?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't think you should do anything that goes through the Palestinian
Authority. Oh, I agree.
If you really want to run a sustainable project that will really benefit the folks and the people who are in need, I think you should just be creative.
No, right.
Creative and go around.
But that's possible.
It is possible. Of course, it's possible. Yeah. If you find the right people, the committed people. And with this tough situation and hard situation, you find a lot of committed people to do good projects, right. Sustainable projects.
So One for Three is based here.
Yeah.
It's a project to raise money to address the water issue. Is that the...
It's the water and health.
Yeah,
issue really. It's organization, a small organization here, based in the Boston area in Winchester, and it has a very good committed team that is really try to work in a partnership with the Palestinians.
Right.
We don't want to go there with the Western view. We're the heroes, and we're gonna you know, we want to teach you how to know. In a partnership, every step of the way, to make, and this is very crucial. Very well-studied and researched project to be owned by the people and sustained by the people. And before we invested anything, we spent around a year and a half researching over and over and over every single thing we have done so far to make sure it's going to work, it's going to be owned by the people, it's going to be sustained. And with this process, we really created jobs, created opportunities. We got the youth of Aida camp get interested in science. And it is tough to get these children to get interested in science. Yeah. So we got them interested in science. Their perspective on the life is different. They're more motivated. Other locations got inspired because now in March we're going to work in another location to start a new water testing program, which is the Walaja village, another extremely difficult location.
We don't have time now, but I know about Walaja, and that's an incredible story.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so I hope you'll come back at some point, talk about Walaja and sort of extend this conversation. And we haven't talked about some of the work being done locally. We have a lot to talk about, but we've run out of time. This is an incredible story, particularly the working together of the people in the Aida camp, One for Three, Tufts University, you know, trying to pull together international community to address this creatively, and with the people in Aida camp. It's incredible work. Thank you.
That was a conversation with Palestinian activist and executive director of the nonprofit organization One for Three, Nidal Al-Azraq. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature an interview with Neri Ramadi, a leading human rights attorney in Israel specializing in freedom of expression and protest. He has been representing Palestinian, Israeli, and international human rights and anti-occupation activists in the military and civil courts since 2008. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.